vaccine initiative. And I ask everyone that's sitting towards the back to come towards the front, because it's a very large room and it's easier for us to have we'll have a warmer session with people down here.
Conversation.
Yeah, and we hope the session will be also an interactive session, which will be really hard if you're sitting in the back of the room. So if people can move forward, that would be great. So welcome to AIDS Vaccines 2010 and Beyond, charting a course for the future of AIDS vaccine research. We have a panel of distinguished experts, a lot of experience here. I'd like to first introduce our chairs for this session, Dr. Slim Abdul Karim from Kapriza, from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, who is a very experienced researcher on HIV prevention, including AIDS vaccines, and has had a very long career of contributions to HIV and AIDS research. And we're keeping the introductions very informal just to set the tone. And I'll also like to introduce Dr. Alan Bernstein, who's the executive director of the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise. Dr. Alan Bernstein used to be based in Canada at the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, and where he was the founding president of that organization and has done a remarkable job there until he was recruited to the international, to the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise. Dr. Bernstein is also a co-sponsor, and on behalf of IAVI, thank you very much for co-sponsoring this session with us. I'll hand it over to our co-chairs to introduce the speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexandro. Now, those of you who are in the back, there's food in the front, so if you want to move forward. It's my deep pleasure to introduce Craig McClure, who will say a few words to open this session. Craig, the most important thing you have to know about Craig is that he's Canadian. And the second most important thing is he is the executive director of the International AIDS Society. So with that, Craig McClure.
Thank you, Alan, fellow Canadian. Good evening, and thank you for inviting me to give opening remarks. Since the last International AIDS Conference in Toronto 2 years ago, the field of HIV vaccine research has had a tough time. In the last 12 months, I understand that meetings of vaccine researchers and advocates alike have been about as much fun as eating crushed glass. Media reports haven't helped. Headlines like, "Will we ever have an AIDS vaccine?" or "HIV vaccine hopes dashed" do not exactly inspire, well, hope. Worse still were the ludicrous and nonsensical calls from some within our own AIDS troops to divert all funding for vaccine research to antiretroviral therapy. I say this is a time for optimism. Why is this a time for optimism in the field of vaccine research? First and foremost, we have a range of excellent, proven prevention and treatment tools in the kit bag, and we finally have substantial resources and political will to implement them. Condoms, clean needles and syringes, opioid substitution therapy, information, counseling, circumcision, STI treatment, and antiretroviral drugs themselves are all excellent prevention interventions. And on the treatment side, we have well over 20 antiretroviral drugs in 5 separate classes, allowing people at least 3 decent shots at undetectabilizing their viral load and living productive and healthy lives. We have generic competition driving down prices, and we have fairly well-coordinated financing mechanisms to fund the response. And that, without belittling the urgent need to develop an HIV vaccine, quite frankly, gives us some time to reflect, to go back to the drawing board, and to learn from what we have achieved to date. Secondly, This is a time when the field is opening up to new ideas. As we move towards the fourth decade of AIDS, we find ourselves in exciting scientific times. Gene therapy and stem cell research are coming into their own. Young, brilliant minds are emerging from universities with bold new ideas. And the setbacks we have faced have led to new discoveries that, while they perplex us, also challenge us to go forward. What is it about this virus that so totally dysregulates our immune systems almost from the moment of infection? Why are the elusive neutralizing antibodies so elusive? What exactly happens during primary infection, and what about those long-term non-progressors? Thirdly, there are growing international calls for research to be expanded in conjunction with the scale-up of current prevention and treatment interventions. Last year, the International AIDS Society issued the Sydney Declaration, calling for 10% of all resources devoted to HIV to go towards research. Since then, WHO, the World Bank, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and the IIS have all joined in the call for expanded research capacity in resource-limited settings, both for operations research, to learn from what we're doing as we scale up, as well as to expand basic clinical, epidemiological, and socioeconomic and behavioral research. Good research drives good policy and programming. The future of the AIDS response will depend on the future of research, including vaccine research. The push for more research as part of a comprehensive response to HIV comes at the same time as a clarion call for health system strengthening. While in some circles there are foolish cries that AIDS is getting too much money, most people in the field of global health realize that the recent unprecedented resources for HIV and global health are beginning to result in success, and that the AIDS movement can be mobilized for global health for all. The rollout of HIV services means not only increased access to ART for those who need it, it also means improved laboratory capacity, trained and retained human resources, improved infrastructure, improved commodities management, and improved monitoring and evaluation programs. All of these can be leveraged to improve overall health systems, including research capacity. Vaccine research is an essential part of a comprehensive response to HIV. Our response to HIV is as extraordinarily unique as the virus itself. HIV vaccine research in the past 25 years has altered and expanded dramatically our understanding of the human immune system. What will be learned in the next 25 years will radically expand that understanding. Whether we have an effective preventive HIV vaccine in 10 years, 20 years, or 50 years, the search must go on. Along the way, there will be more setbacks and hopefully a few eureka moments. We need to remember that old mantra of Seth Berkley's, "The race for an AIDS vaccine is a marathon, not a sprint." What we now know is that marathon is a relay that may need to pass from generation to generation. There will be no greater tool to ultimately end this epidemic than a preventive HIV vaccine. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy your deliberations this evening.
Thank you very much, Craig. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome and introduce to the podium Dr. Seth Berkley, who I'm sure needs no introduction, but I thought I would just touch on one or two points about Seth. So most of you might not be aware that Seth's first exposure and interaction and coming to face-to-face with the HIV epidemic was in Uganda. That was soon after he had been at the CDC. So he knows the face of the epidemic where it hit worst. And he has that perspective of the way in which communities have risen to the challenge of the HIV epidemic. Since then, he had moved back to the U.S. and had been at the Rockefeller Foundation when he created IAVI. And currently, besides being the president of IAVI, he also holds academic faculty positions and professorships at both Columbia University and at Brown University. I know of no one who shares this passion for vaccines and who has been able to stand up and shout loudest from the rooftops for a vaccine. So he's going to tell us today the state of the vaccine field and share with us some of the prospects that lie ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Slim. And let me just start by saying something about Slim that people may not know, which is he was chair of the 2000 critical Durban meeting. And at that meeting, it was not only a very important time for antiretroviral therapy, but it was a very important time for vaccines. And vaccines were on the agenda virtually every day through every time slot, and was unbelievably supportive of that. Second point I want to make, I guess Craig has had to leave, but I did want to say that Craig's first, one of his first loves was as a AIDS vaccine activist and was very active in Canada working on AIDS vaccines. And so it was wonderful to have him come and give remarks. Alex has given me an impossible task. He's asked me to, in 10 or 15 minutes, give you a state of the field. I'm going to try my best to do that. And given that we've got an audience of people working on everything from science to the activism to community, I'm going to try to make it relevant for everybody. Summary, I'm going to start off talking about why an AIDS vaccine, where we are now, good and bad news, and what this means, and then how we prepare for the next couple of years and beyond. Now, I don't think I need to say this for this audience, but I do want to remind everybody that the reason we need a vaccine is because AIDS and HIV is still continuing to devastate communities. You know the numbers, but particularly women bear the brunt of the epidemic, representing, you know, almost half of all HIV-infected adults worldwide, and certainly the vast majority in Africa. This is critical because women need tools that are friendly to women that they can control. And ultimately, obviously, we need microbicides, better barrier methods, but a vaccine is the best tool to do that. So without a vaccine, we're going to see the epidemic continuing. And I think the data that came out of the U.S., people focused on the fact that there were more cases. Yes, that's an important issue. It's important for planning and because of the sheer magnitude of the disease. But I think hidden in there was the fact that it's now 15 years that despite scale-up of treatment, despite scale-up of prevention, we're still seeing 60,000 cases a year over this time period, suggesting we need better tools. So Craig has already said AIDS vaccines should be part of a sustainable, comprehensive response to use the tools we have today to prevent the further spread of the virus, treat those who are infected, and mitigate the societal impacts. But we must invest in better tools. And it's not just vaccines. Better drugs, better diagnostics, better barrier methods, microbicides, and ultimately a vaccine. And we also have to remember that if we look at the current demands to try to get to access for all by 2010, the costs are enormous. Lower and middle income countries, it's estimated that Access for All by 2015 will be $54 billion a year going on from there. And so better prevention and better prevention tools are critical to being able to financially support that. What could a vaccine do? Well, it could have a very dramatic effect. What's important is that even if a vaccine didn't have unbelievably high efficacy or coverage, you still could avert a lot of infections. And obviously, the better it is, the more the coverage, the better the response. These are some modelings that were done, pretty sophisticated modeling looking at the effects of vaccines. So we have to remember that although we want a perfect vaccine, even an imperfect vaccine can have a dramatic effect. Lastly, people say, well, that's all fine and good, but, you know, is an AIDS vaccine possible? You heard Craig say that people have been saying it's not. And what I would say to that is that we know that immune control of HIV is possible. We know that most people who get HIV infected control the infection, suppress viral load for a period of time before they have slow destruction of their immune system. We know there are people resistant, highly exposed uninfected, children of infected mothers, and then these long-term non-progressors who are nature's kind of experiments, in essence, of people who control infection for many, many years, some to undetectable levels. We also know that there are experimental candidate vaccines and ways of looking at this that have shown effect. The live attenuated vaccine works well against homologous challenge in macaques, at least the best model we have now. And neutralizing antibodies from humans put into macaques can give you sterilizing immunity. So we have lots of information in humans and in monkeys that it's possible. The question is how to make it practical. So where are we now? So I'm going to go back because I think it's important to ask where we were a little bit more than a decade ago. And in that period, there was very little things in the pipeline, very little vaccines. There was little investment by the public or private sectors. In those years, about $150 million worldwide. No vaccine had ever been tested for efficacy. There was little interest in vaccines. There was very little interest in vaccines for high-incident countries. Nobody had designed vaccines for those regions. There was no trials occurring in the developing world. There was limited capacity for trials. And there was no political leadership for vaccines in the North or South. We've come a really long way since then. And so that's some of the good news. There's been a big growth in funding. We've gone from this $150 million to today's total, I believe, is $961 million, which is what the working group on this funding released a report here at this conference on that, and this summarizes that growth. One thing that's important about seeing this is that the pharmaceutical sector has been relatively flat and is a minority of it. Most of the funding now is coming from the public sector and most from the U.S. government. And this is something that, as activists, we have to try to make sure that we get broad-based support for AIDS vaccine. There's now efforts in place to inform and engage affected communities across the world. This is really exciting, and we've seen community advisory boards work south-to-south cooperation across the world, not only within Africa, but across Asia, from Asia to Africa to Latin America and back. So it's really become a truly global effort. There's a lot more capacity for research in developing countries. This happens to be an IAVI site, and this is what was started before, built a beautiful facility. But more importantly, this laboratory is not only done a bunch of trials, has good clinical practice, good laboratory practice, has gone on to be accredited as a laboratory, and then went on to become a reference laboratory for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a collaboration for AIDS vaccine development. So this shows the quality of work that is going on in these places that were not part of the AIDS vaccine effort more than a decade ago. Now there's 26 countries that have done trial, many in the developing world, again, bringing a global perspective to this. And this is critical because we know there are different strains of virus circulating in the world, and also the genetics are different. So making this a global effort is absolutely critical. And finally, there's been a lot more political leadership over the last decade. Leaders from India have declared this a national goal. You see pictures here of Bill and Melinda Gates, who have made this into their highest priority of the foundation and almost a campaign. Gordon Brown, who's made this a priority, and Yoweri Museveni, et cetera, I can go on and on. So truly global effort. And perhaps most important, there's been an extraordinary growth in scientific knowledge. It's breathtaking, what we know about the virus, what we know about the immune system. So you can look at, say, the glass is half empty, that we don't know everything, we don't understand everything. That's true, but we know an enormous amount. And this cover of Nature looks at the structure of one of the broadly neutralizing antibodies and where it binds to, and these give clues to science to make better products. The bad news is finding a vaccine is extraordinarily complicated. Why? Well, the virus itself integrates, so you have to get to it very quickly. It has hypervariability. There's different strains circulating around the world. We don't understand the immune correlates of protection. We know that HIV suppresses and kills cells of the immune system. It targets the immune system itself, which is what we need to rally to protect against it. We don't have perfect animal models, and clinical trials are long and costly. But what that means is that although we're attacking an aggressive and fast-moving target, we have to test in people. This is a human disease, HIV. So we can use monkeys, we can use, you know, laboratory animals to give us clues, but at the end of the day, we have to test in humans, and success is going to take a lot of time. There's a whole series of other issues around policy and political will to be able to do this, given it is a marathon, you've heard. We've got to have high-level global commitment leading to action. We've got to have incentives for industry to engage in this. They're not spending it using shareholders' resources, so we've got to help because they are critical. There's ethical, regulatory, and IP challenges and health systems challenge. So to do that, we have to build this global support and optimize the environment for safe and ethical trials. Other bad news is that the current pipeline is inadequate. The focus has been on cellular immunity almost exclusively. We need to move into neutralizing antibodies, mucosal immunity, combination of these, and other areas that aren't even listed here. So where is the world? As of August 2008, there's been two efficacy trials completed. The VaxGen GP120 showed no efficacy. That was an antibody-based vaccine that focused on lab-adapted strains, and although it gave good antibodies against lab-adapted strains, didn't provide protection against wild-type. And the Merck candidate, which I will talk about because I think it's important for everybody here to know about that. There is an efficacy trial ongoing, Sanofi and VaxGen. That's an Alvac candidate. We're expecting data next year. This is being done in Thailand, 16,000 people. There are a whole bunch of other candidates in clinical trials, and Jorge Beloki reminded me to make sure this is said because the plenary that went on vaccines was looking forward and didn't talk about the important work that's going on. There's a whole range of other products that are moving forward, including a decision soon from the NIH on whether they're going to move forward with a DNA Ad5, and that discussion is ongoing. As you know, there was a decision made not to move it forward in the design it was in, but there was also a sense that if a smaller trial went forward, that would move forward. There's also a whole range of other products in phase one, and our assessment is that ultimately the best of these, and what do I mean by the best of these, ones that look better than the Merck product, will then move into a screening test of concept type trials, and we'll see if these approaches provide advances over the candidates that are above. This is a list, I'm not going to go through this, of candidates that are in clinical trials, and so you can see the pipeline is far from empty, but again, we need more diversity in the pipeline. And so what that means is it's likely that there's going to be a dip in the pipeline and not that many things as in the past has been tested, but there's going to be a rise again as all the new work that's going on leads to new candidates. Let me just mention what happened with Merck. This was a phase 2B trial of an Ad5 Gagpol Neph. It was an excellently designed trial, multi-center, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled phase 2 test of concept. Started with the STEP trial, which was 3,000 people, 15 with low pre-existing Ad5 antibodies, and 15 with higher levels. And then there was another trial in South Africa, the Fumbili trial, that was started later. The Data Safety and Monitoring Board, at their first meeting, stopped the trial for futility. And again, this was an excellently designed trial, really excellently designed. And the data at that time showed, in fact, that there was no difference in viral load between the two groups, and there was no difference in infection rates between the two groups, although there was a trend towards a higher infection rate in those who received vaccine. That was concerning. This was not statistically significant, which is important. And if you looked at the people who had low Ad5 titers, there was no difference between the two groups. But people later found out that, in fact, there was a higher infection rate in the group who received vaccine than in placebo. And what's interesting, if you go back and look at the HIV rates in the vaccine versus placebo, in the low Ad5 titers, you can see a slightly higher rate in vaccine than placebo. a little bit higher in the HIAD fives, but also the placebo rate went down, the infection rate, which confounded the effect. And so one of the issues, and as I said, this was an excellently done trial, when we look at the randomization that occurred, it was excellently randomized, but one of the issues is there are differences between those who have low AD5 titers and those who have high AD5 titers, and one of the questions is, are there potential confounding that we haven't identified yet? And there's a fabulous program now to go back and look at the data, try to do studies to figure out if there are other factors such as HSV or other exposures that might explain this. But at the moment, of course, for safety reasons, people are worried about this, and that's what delayed the VRC trial. So the upside of the bad news is that the failure from this trial has challenged the field to be more efficient, to prioritize its future candidates. The scientific agenda is changing to reflect these science findings, and that's the normal process of product development. You have a failure of a candidate, you learn from that, you take those learnings, put it into the next candidates. So for today's priorities, we need better assays to predict efficacy. That's an important issue. Up until this point, we looked at gamma interferon ELISpots, and Merck, you know, gave pretty high levels of those, and, you know, that's not the best thing. We need T-cell functional assays. We need candidates that can elicit broadly neutralizing antibodies and more potent targeted cellular immunity, and we probably need to better understand what's in the vaccine, and most of the focus in the vectored approaches has been on the vectors and not necessarily what's in it, and so a lot can be done there. So now preparing for the next couple of years and beyond. So what's going to happen post the Merck vaccine? What's the impact? Well, first of all, there's been a shift, a slight, as Tony Fauci said, a twisting of the knob towards discovery. He did not say we're abandoning clinical research. Clinical research is critical to the field and to the discovery effort. So a tweak of the knob towards discovery. So NIH has said that they're going to be redirecting funds there. The enterprise has been reviewing this and looking at suggestions. And there's a greater focus on neutralizing antibodies and validating the SIV model because we now have a negative validation of the SHIV model. We don't yet have a positive, obviously, validation of the SIV, and that'll be critical. For the clinical research agenda, we're going to adapt to the capacity to answer today's question, a lot more clinical research rather than licensure trials. So it's going to be small trials trying to answer critical questions, and obviously if you have positive, then you'll roll them into larger trials, but not to go very large trials to start with. In the absence of these intermediate efficacy trials right now, there's maybe some excess capacity, and we're going to have to use that smartly and sustain it. That's important. It takes years to build this capacity, and we can't let that capacity disappear. We obviously have to develop better assays. We've mentioned that. The funding landscape is changing. Large pharma, which wasn't investing very heavily even up to this point now, is cutting back further, so it's even more on the shoulders of the public sector. And there's going to be more investment in upstream research. And then we do believe that as a result of the STEP trial, there's probably going to be greater regulatory hurdles, which may slow down clinical development. And the STEP results may also change the way we think about doing trials. And one of the important things about this is there's a lot of very interesting work on innovative trial design that can help prioritize promising candidates swiftly. And I think more of that will be seen. If you think about it, what this cartoon does, and this is from our blueprint, we're going to be looking at a set of immunogens and a set of different candidates, and we're going to be looking at issues of technical feasibility, small animal models, then looking at non-human primates, then early clinical trials, and then that's going to lead to a prioritization of candidates going into these, you know, small efficacy type trials to look for some proof of efficacy in humans, and then ultimately that will lead to larger efficacy trials. Oops, sorry. Lastly, let me just say that scientists alone can't solve this problem. Research doesn't happen in a vacuum. We've often said that bad science will kill the effort, but so will bad political will, community involvement, advocacy engagement. And so with a reduced clinical pipeline, how can we engage the clinical trial centers in the developing world that have done such a superb job to make sure they continue to actively engage in the effort? And We've got to sustain the capacity that was built. We've got to use it effectively. But we also, where possible, have to get these research centers engaged in some of the upstream research. And obviously, that has to be done appropriately and make sure that there's adequate capacity in countries to do the research that people are trained for and exchanges. But that's an important priority. How do we keep the communities informed and engaged over the course of many years in the face of multiple priorities? We'll discuss that on the panel. But this is a critical issue, because if you have the communities lose desire and don't want to volunteer, don't want to have trials in their areas, it's a huge problem. How do we keep the advocacy engaged? And what are we going to do? What effect is it going to have on the volunteers, activists, donors, political leaders, and young scientists? So it's critical to redouble our efforts on advocacy. And finally, what can the broader age response that Craig talked about contribute to accelerating research? And how do we integrate our research into other prevention research, such as PrEP, such as other research that's going on, to support today's goal as well as tomorrow's needs? We released our AIDS vaccine blueprint. We do that every 2 years. So there are copies of it for everybody. We released here the PRAISIS, and there's a full-length blueprint, which is, for those working in the field, much more interesting. And that has the big deal we tried to put in this year, in addition to our normal covering the state of the field and giving recommendations, is a set of interim milestones. We don't necessarily know that these are the right interim milestones, but we believe the field ought to be broken up into interim milestones now, and we all ought to agree what those are, and then we ought to go after them, because that'll allow us to tick off critical things that have to be solved for us to get to where we go. And so that was the main thing. We talked about three waves of vaccine development in the blueprint. The first wave, like hepatitis B, the early years ended when the VaxGen approach looked like it wasn't promising. The second wave, the cellular immunity moving forward, which in a sense ended with Merck. And the third wave, which we called harnessing innovation throughout the field. And this is across the entire field, on the preclinical side, really being bold and strategic, engaging industry and seeking ideas from other fields, in clinical trials, adaptive enrolling trial design, smaller trials, in partnerships, new ways, better models to keep us going, in advocacy, developing the next generation of advocates, working with women's groups, advocates for other diseases, and in developing country engagement, how do we engage the work that they can do strategically and get them even more involved? We have to persevere. Vaccines are very powerful tools, but they take decades to develop, and there's a lot of experience, a lot of years for a lot of vaccines, and HIV vaccines are probably the toughest vaccine that the world has ever worked on. So I'd like to end by, of course, thanking our donors, which we couldn't do our work without, and we have a fabulous set of donors that support us and allow us to be flexible in what we do and move with the science as necessary. And at the end of the day, I think all of us here want to imagine a world without AIDS, and that's what we're really working towards. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Seth, for that very comprehensive overview of the field and where it is and where it's going. When Seth first asked me to co-chair this with Slim Karim, I immediately said yes, because it gives me an opportunity to work with Slim, somebody who I knew when I first met him back in May of this year would be a friend and colleague for life. So it's a real pleasure and honor for me to be working with you, Slim, on this. The title of this session is AIDS Vaccines 2010 and Beyond, Charting a Course for the Future. So there are at least three words that talk about the future here. It reminds me that Marshall McLuhan, who is a well-known futurist, really didn't like that term, and every time he was asked about predicting the future, he had a quip that he'd come back with, and one of them was, predicting the future is passé. So with that in mind, I want to urge our panelists to remember two things. This is about the future, and you don't necessarily have to crystal ball, but I think we are interested in hearing each of your views separately and in a conversation about where you think the field is going and needs to go. And secondly, to keep the 5 minutes. Okay, so that we have time for a dialogue. It's my pleasure to introduce and call to the podium our first speaker, Dr. David Apuli. I, as with Slim, first met David in May of this year, One's immediately struck by a lot of things: his warm personality, his humor, his passion for the battle against HIV, and the combination of being that personality with being a superb administrator, a politician, and one of the strongest supporters for HIV vaccine research anywhere, and certainly in Africa. He is the Director General of the Uganda AIDS Commission and has been for almost a decade. He's an MD. He's on the IAVI's Policy Advisory Committee. I think he chairs it. And is a board member of the Infectious Disease Institute in Kampala in Uganda and a member of the PEPFAR board. David?
Thank you, Alan. Thank you. And I thank all those who invited me. I traveled from very far to come here. It is a long way. And it is a pleasure to be able to say a few words. And really what I'm going to say is, what is the perspective from a policymaker's side, especially people like ourselves who are involved in coordinating a response at country level and playing a role in terms of advocacy and various levels on the globe. And I'll keep mine very simple. And they told me it should take less than 5 minutes, which is not much. The last few days, all of you have heard, and you come out with definitely a feeling that we cannot treat ourselves out of this epidemic. The figures speak for themselves. Faith showed you some of the figures. The number of people who were put on treatment in 2007 is a small fraction of the new infection that occurred. In fact, I believe that some of this success we are talking about in this conference is transient. Because I speak from the perspective of my own country and my neighboring country, Kenya, where there was success, but in the last few years, after careful analysis of data, we see the number of new infections rising. So, I think this success we're talking about in this conference is transient. And that compels us to think outside the box. The second thing that I learned out of this conference is that, in fact, provision of ARVs in terms of sustainability and resources is going to be very difficult. And I talk from a policy perspective because when we are talking at country level, we are going to tell our people, this is what will happen. You have to convince them. There are competing demands. And our resource envelope is limited. Only 41% of the people in the world who need ARVs are getting them. In my country, it's only 42%. And in fact, when you calculate the amount of resources that will be required over the next 5 years in Uganda for ARVs to make sure that 80% of the people who need them get them, we require in excess of $1 billion. Now, that's one country. If it when the PEPFAR reauthorization gives $48 billion for everything, that's just a small fraction of all the countries. How much shall we need for the whole world? So that compels us to think that, in fact, we must target what we do. The facts are glaring in front of us that, in fact, a vaccine is the only way out. And that's what I say. That's why I'm a very big advocate of vaccine, AIDS vaccine. And I think Faith knows this. But it is important that these facts are presented to various levels, from the highest echelon of governance and civil society to the lowest level. And I think that is important. Sometimes that is the missing link, because I find in a conference like this, there is activism about many other things, including treatment. There is no activism about an AIDS vaccine. As somebody said, there is no activism about prevention. I didn't see it and haven't seen it. Now, the STEP trial and the cancelled PEP study indeed dampened our hope. But I think our resolve must remain resolute because the information earned through these research efforts compel us to believe that an AIDS vaccine is possible. I think Seis has said this, and I'm going to repeat it. We have phenomena that we know, discordance, late converters, A, B, C, D, and we know that these things happen. And therefore, we know we can find a vaccine. But we must remain resolute and determined to find the final blow that will finish off this virus. As I said on Sunday, we had a forum. I said, sleeping is not falling. And I'm quoting a politician from our neighboring country, Kenya. If you're walking in a slippery area and you just sleep, that's not falling. You stand up and you continue. And I think that's what we must do. And history, of course, reminds us that road for vaccine research and development is long, rough, and full of potholes. But we must go on all the way and eventually triumph. And I come to some very important point as a policy, somebody involved in policy. In explaining the above scenario to our political, religious, technical, and community leaders, we need to simplify the language. My personal as well as experience with President Yoweri Museveni, who is the president of Uganda, late at night in a hotel room in Bangkok in 2004, is still valid in my mind. Seis came. He was trying to explain to the president the importance of an AIDS vaccine. And the president said, oh, this virus, is it like an enemy that comes and is able to wipe out the whole armed forces of our country, the army, the air force, the navy, the intelligence? And he said, yes. It's like an armored enemy whom you cannot shoot at, even with all missiles. He said, yes. Anyway, it was an animated discussion. At the end of the day, Seis got one of the best advocates for vaccines on the African continent. And Seis is very clever. The president said, so what do you want me to do? He said, Mr. President, I want you to write to the G8 and tell them that we need more resources for AIDS vaccine research. And he said, please go and draft this letter. I'll sign it. And he did. The rest is history. And you know what happened in Scotland. Now, but all this I say, we must be able to explain to our other people who are not in this room, who are not in this conference. Today, as I say, there is only one pipeline. And the blueprint gives us reasons why we must now think again, looking at all arms of the human immune system or response. What he was talking about really are the different arms of our body, how we respond. We didn't waste time, as he said. We have learned a lot. We have built capacity. You are seeing pictures of those beautiful labs in Uganda. We have very good scientists. And really, we have gained. The only thing I think I want to put simply is those of you who attend the prevention Lancet series yesterday, we talked about combination prevention. I think, Seis, we need to talk about combination research approach. Looking at the human immune system in parallel and in combination, as you said. Finally, because I don't know whether I've finished my 5 minutes. I must finish. I'm sorry. Finally, I want to say that my voice is from the South. Sub-Saharan Africa is bearing the brunt of this epidemic. And to be foolhardy and illogical to exclude developing countries from participating in AIDS vaccine research. The clades are different all over Africa, and an AIDS vaccine must be such that it would be of use in all parts of the world, especially in Africa. We have demonstrated our capacity to participate, and Uganda takes pride in the contributions our scientists and research volunteers have made. We thank our research partners for supporting the scientific capacity building in Uganda, and we wish to see this continue. We ask for the voices of support from the developing world to join with the voices from Africa to tell the doubting Thomases that Africa must have an AIDS vaccine. I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much, David. So I think Alan gave you a perspective that the purpose of this session is really to give us a sense of, you know, how we're moving forward. But if I can, for just a few seconds, take you back to 1996, which Seth had a slide on. So in 1996, vaccine research was really completely underdeveloped or undeveloped in South Africa. So I invited two people to come there and help stimulate and get us galvanized to think about HIV vaccines. And the two people I invited were Seth Berkley and Peggy Johnson. And it was in this meeting of about 100 people that Peggy gave a presentation which changed my life. In those days, I used to have a lot of hair, so it didn't look anything like this. But I sat there, mouth agape, listening to the science, and it was inspirational. And so, you know, they say in your lifetime, you're very fortunate if you have three or four people who have served to inspire you. Well, I'm now presenting to you somebody who has inspired me with her depth of understanding and a knowledge of HIV and the way she's able to put it all together so you get the big picture. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Peggy Johnston, Director of Vaccine Research at AIDS in the NIH. Peggy.
Thank you, Slim. Are you trying to say it's my fault that you've lost your hair on your head? Yes. I apologize for that, but if it converted you to a vaccine aficionado, it was worth every hair on your head. What I'm going to do in 5 minutes is talk a little bit about the scientific priorities and what the US NIH has been doing to help contribute to those priorities. And I have the advantage in that we held a scientific summit not too long ago and got the input of several hundred researchers in person at the summit, as well as over 700 individuals that watched the summit on a webcast. So I'm going to give you the output of what we heard. And the bottom line of this was that we needed to torque our investment in AIDS vaccine research more toward discovery and discovery-related research, and a little less around the empiric classical approaches of trying to find an AIDS vaccine. And what that means is many things. First, it means understanding why people who are infected don't typically induce broadly neutralizing antibodies, and also translating the information that we now have about the structures on the HIV envelope that are the targets of broadly neutralizing antibodies and translating that information into an immunogen that can induce those broadly neutralizing antibodies in vaccinated individuals. Another key priority for us is to understand the earliest steps of infection, including the role of innate and mucosal immunity in natural infection. Now, as we heard this morning with Bob Silicano, that window of opportunity that we have from the time the virus enters to the time when it firmly establishes itself in latency is a matter of days. Now, with other vaccines, we never had to worry about understanding whether innate or mucosal immunity played a role, because a more empiric classical approach of making a vaccine worked. Well, we're now at a point in the HIV field where we have to figure out what these things mean and see if there are ways that we can manipulate that and extend that window of opportunity and give the immune response more of an opportunity to get going and control, if not eliminate the virus. So there are also cues that we can get from studying exposed uninfected individuals, macaques that have high retroviral levels in SIV infection and don't get disease. Another message from our summit was to more closely link the non-human primate and the human studies so that we can better understand the significance of various non-human primate models and be able to more directly compare the data that we get from those two systems. And also, most importantly on the clinical side, to understand more thoroughly the results of the STEP trial. And I personally believe that the STEP trial was one of the best accomplishments of the last year, even though the vaccine failed. There's nothing like human data, a human experiment, to reset one's priorities. We learned an awful lot from that trial, even though the vaccine didn't work. We learned, first of all, that natural immunity to the viral vector is something that we're going to have to pay attention to because it may play a detrimental role to outcome. We learned that a smaller trial design can give a result efficiently and effectively, not only about the efficacy, but also about the safety of the vaccine. And we also recalibrated, as a result of the STEP trial, how we view non-human primate models and which ones we wish to pursue and utilize more thoroughly. So as we move forward, understanding the results of the STEP trial are going to be very important. For example, knowing the sequences of the viruses that vaccinees became infected with will tell us whether the immune responses in those vaccinees provided any immune pressure on the virus that infected those people. If that turns out to be the case, then we can build on that to get broader responses and hopefully broader pressure on the virus and broader control. I think it's also important for us to learn at what happened at the tissue level, at the mucosal level. So far, we don't have any hints from what circulates in the blood that helps explain the increased risk of acquisition that occurred in men who entered the trial with prior immunity to the Ad5 virus, natural immunity to the Ad5 virus, and who were uncircumcised. And we need to understand that. So what have we started to do to tackle these scientific priorities? Well, first of all, on the clinical end, our HIV vaccine trials network has revised its scientific agenda, again, to follow up on the STEP results first and foremost, both to use existing specimens in collaboration with researchers outside the network to learn as much as we can about what happened, and also to potentially do some additional trials that will be more invasive in nature so that we can find out what is going on at the local sites of exposure when one is exposed to a viral vector such as Ad5. In addition, and importantly, we look forward to working with partners to develop more assays, potentially better assays, that will hopefully more accurately predict the outcome in a clinical trial than the assays we have been using. So in addition to the clinical research that we hope will inform discovery, we're also going to focus on non-human primate research. And that is starting by having the HIV vaccine trials soon to elicit a request for proposals to work with them to more closely link the non-human primate and clinical studies. We're also going to be working with partners to expand capacity to provide non-human primates to researchers because as more research has been funded in AIDS vaccine development, the demand for non-human primates has now far exceeded the supply, and we need to address that as quickly as possible. We are planning a couple of workshops, one in conjunction with the non-human primate symposium in Puerto Rico to encourage the application of genomics research to non-human primate research, and then one a little later in the year, which will help inform us as to what specific initiatives in the non-human primate arena we should consider for the coming year or two. So in addition to clinical and non-human primate, other areas of discovery are high on our research agenda. We will be pouring money into discovery research and having new initiatives to solicit investigator-initiated research. One of these is currently on the street and actually goes a little beyond vaccine research. Because even though we are confident that a vaccine can be obtained, we definitely want to hedge our bets and look for other approaches that we might be able to institute that can protect from transmission. This initiative is called HITIT, Highly Innovative Tactics to Interrupt Transmission. And so we're hoping to bring in some research that will look at novel ways of exploiting what we know about the interaction of HIV with the host to kind of block that system. So in summary, we're at a turning point scientifically in the field. We're getting lots of input. We're continuing to get lots of input. And we're trying to implement actions based on the input as quickly as we possibly can. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Peggy. Being relatively new to the field, I've turned to a lot of people for advice about who I should get to know and who's a key scientist and opinion leader. And one of the people I've relied on a lot is Jose Esparza, who's a senior policy advisor for HIV/AIDS at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And he oversees the very significant investments that the Gates Foundation is making in vaccine research. And when I asked Jose, who's a key person, a key scientist in Latin America, the first person and the only person that he told me was Mauro Schachter. And so it's a real pleasure for me to introduce Mauro Schachter to you. Mauro is the professor of infectious diseases at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. He works on the HIV pathogenesis, the natural history of the disease, and according to Science magazine, is the most cited author in Latin America working on HIV/AIDS research. Mauro?
So now I know. Thank you. So now I know who either to thank or blame or both for being here. What I was asked to do was to talk briefly from a perspective of a clinical researcher working in Latin America. I've been involved with HIV vaccine-related studies for almost 15 years, initially with what was then called PAVE, became HIVNET, and is now known as HVTN. Over these decade and a half, we and others in Rio de Janeiro built a site capable of conducting good quality research, a site that's capable of going through an FDA audit with zero findings. And anyone who's been through an FDA audit knows it's not a fun experience, and having no findings at all is also quite a testimony to the quality of the clinical research being done by the team. So what we learned in a very schematic way is that what seems obvious, but it's not that obvious, to conduct a clinical trial, one needs a product, a population, and investigators capable of conducting the trial. Having a population means building trust. Having a team of investigators means investing on training, particularly in settings like ours in developing countries, in which there is no research career. There's no, when you go to medical school or to nursing school, whatever you do, no one tells you that there exists a career in research. So you need to motivate, find these people, train them, and keep them. So both trust and training healthcare workers take very long to build, but both of them take very, very little to destroy. It's one moment they're here, next moment they're gone. So I think the present dilemma after the news we heard of the trials that did not succeed in terms of show efficacy, although as Seth reminded us, the STEP trial was an extremely well-designed trial and was a very successful trial because it gave an answer and quickly. But the present dilemma is what do we do in order not to destroy what took us so long to build? And what can we do to make sure that the infrastructure we built is there when the next vaccine comes? There will be a vaccine to be tested, and we need the infrastructure to be there when that happens. And we need also to be prepared when that happens to not only keep the trust we built with the communities we've been working the last few years, but also communities we never managed to reach. And again, Seth brought the point of women. And in every single trial, one of the main problems has been how to recruit high-risk women. And that's a thing we've been failing and we need to tackle. So very briefly, in other words, to my mind, and that's straight to the point, what are the bridging activities one needs to do in our setting, in Latin America or other developing countries, while we're waiting for the next vaccine that will come? So I think we need two things in very broadly. One is finding ways to maintain our teams. And what we've been doing at my site, we've been trying to get more involved with trials of drugs with Big Pharma. We've been involved now with the PrEP studies, so the prevention trial that we're dealing in a way with similar populations. And we're trying to advocate, as we're doing now, for our centers, our sites, to participate in earlier phase trials. And on the population side, what we're trying to do, because the PrEP trial keeps our contacts with the gay community, we're trying to get small grants to run small studies that can allow us to establish a relationship with commercial sex workers in Rio de Janeiro. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mauro. So the final member of our panel this evening, to give a short input, is Dr. Suniti Solomon. Now, Suniti, for those of you who are not aware, is one of the pioneers in India on HIV and AIDS treatment. In fact, I went to visit her in Chennai, where she runs an amazing program called YRG Care. Well, not only is she a pioneer in the treatment area, she's also a leading figure in the HIV vaccine field. In fact, is doing a vaccine trial in Chennai. So it's our pleasure and honor to have this evening with us Suniti Solomon. Thank you.
Thank you. My task is to talk about clinical trials and community engagement. We all know that without the community, there is no clinical trials. No volunteers, no trials. We need to recruit and retain them. When YRG Care got its first clinical trial funded by the NIH, we didn't know how to go about. And the first thing we did was to build rapport with the community. We went to maybe 40, 50 different communities in Chennai, where we built a rapport to find out what their needs are, so that there is a true partnership between the scientists and the community, and there is mutual trust. And then we built what is known as the Community Advisory Board, about which I had never heard before. And we included in this Community Advisory Board people from different communities. They were sex workers, they were drug users, MSM, HIV positive people, the police, the advocates, doctors, and they wouldn't sit next to each other. But we had to build them. And over a period of years, today they are of such great help to recruit volunteers, whichever clinical trial we do. So that was the first beginning of the rapport. And then came a vaccine trial, a phase one vaccine trial, an MVA vaccine trial, which the trial went to the ICMR center, and they needed to recruit volunteers. They struggled. So finally, YRG Care was called in to recruit volunteers. It's very important to start talking to the community right at the time we are thinking of a vaccine trial, because roughly it takes 6 months to build up that mutual trust and recruit volunteers. So it took us some time, but we were able to get the 32 volunteers within the next 4 months, and the vaccine trial went into being. So that is about the rapport we build with the community. The second most important thing is we need to build also a rapport with the media, because media involvement is very, very important in any trial. The media can write whatever they want and your trial is gone. So we need to make sure that the media comes out with the right thing. So we had a media workshop where we explained about the vaccine trial. People were worried, HIV vaccine, will I become positive? That was the first question. And so it is very important to give in simple language the details to the media and to the political people so that the right information comes out. The next, I think what is, I'm just giving five bullet points. The next point I would like to talk about is the dissemination at the end of the trial. We always forget the community. We always forget the volunteers. It's so important that they don't get the message from media or from a third party. It is our duty to tell them that what the results of. For example, we had a phase 3 trial of a microbicide cellulose sulfate, where we had enrolled in our center 500 sex workers. So the minute the results came out, and the results were not good, I'm sure you all know that, so we had to go to the sex workers whom we had recruited and give them the results. Luckily for us, there was not a single zero incidence. So that brings me to the next point. How do you choose a community? Now, in the state I come from in India, the zero incidence is almost nil. And most of the clinical trials, the end point is zero conversion. So if there's no zero conversion, we can't get that community to be part of the trial. So that is another important thing we need to talk about. Most of the community people ask us, okay, we join your trial. If I zero convert, what is the standard of care you're going to give us? Who is funding this trial? Will we get the same standard as the people who are funding? So if I become positive, will I get treatment for the rest of my life? You know, these are points we need to talk about. Also about the cultural acceptability. Everybody is talking about the success of circumcision. Let me tell you, it will never work in India, because the Hindus object to it. It's a religious problem. So we have to be very culturally appropriate when we plan a trial. Lastly, I would like to talk about distributive justice. In most of the clinical trials, it's from the low socioeconomic people get recruited. And the vaccine or the drugs come out. They're so expensive, these poor people cannot afford to get it. So the risks and benefits have to be across every strata of the society, gender-wise, economic-wise, so that the whole community will benefit from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. I'm going to kick off this panel discussion with a question, and then Slim, if you have one, you'll jump in. But I would invite the audience to start thinking about questions or points you'd like to make, because the panel discussion will go on for about 15 minutes or so, and then I'd like to open it up to all of you. This is a satellite about the future, and the future, of course, is about young people, and young people make the future. And Craig McClure, in his opening remarks, talked about a relay race. This is a marathon relay race, and having to pass the baton on to the next generation of researchers. The Enterprise, with a lot of partners, held a satellite on Sunday, which seems like about 10 years ago now, where we discussed some of the issues around young people and the barriers and the opportunities that they face in getting engaged and involved in HIV research generally and vaccine research in particular. It was an outstanding session, I thought. And I guess my question to all the panel members from your very different perspectives is, what in your view should and could and is being done to make sure that we do have somebody to pass the baton to? And maybe not to put anybody too much on the spot, I'll ask Dr. Apuli from the perspective of Africa, and you made the comment about Africa needs to be engaged in HIV vaccine research. Your thoughts about how to engage young African scientists in this effort.
Thank you very much, Ellen. We were discussing one afternoon about how can we tap the young scientists in African universities who have got innovative ideas but may not necessarily have any sources of funds. And I think we need to be able to establish linkages with our various universities and faculties. And I'm sure if there were small either grants, either doctoral work or postgraduate work in these areas, we'll be able to attract scientists who join the pipeline of the pool that will provide what is needed for the future. And I think this is possible. This is possible and can be explored. And we talked about it. And the networks can be established.
It's interesting you make that suggestion, because that suggestion also came out in the satellite from a young researcher at SLIM's institution, actually. So that's interesting that it's come up twice. Anybody else want to jump in on this one?
Can I make a comment? Yeah, I'll make a comment. Because that's the point that I failed to mention, which I think you're right. About two or three years ago, was sort of a mantra that I kept going on and on about what we're doing wrong in HIV research in general in developing countries, because you don't see new researchers everywhere you go. It's the same face, it's just all of us in the mid-50s, and you'll see myself, see James, and you see Bill Papos. It's the same guys. Where is the next generation? And I think in the vaccine field, we'll fail again if, when, as you said, is a relay marathon, when we have, every time we have a problem, we just shut down the sites and tell them, look, next time. So we're not giving the right message if we don't tell all the researchers, this is a related race, a long race, but if you join now, you'll be able to have a career, be able to work for a period of time, not that you're going to work for 2 years and then it's gone.
Yeah. Peggy?
I think as we put more emphasis on discovery research, that will make it somewhat easier to attract younger people in the field. Because I think what we'll be looking for is the application of new technologies to HIV vaccines. So young researchers who have learned those new technologies in other areas, whether it's genomics, proteomics, whole genomes analysis, and so forth, they'll have opportunities to bring those tools into the HIV field. I think the other point I'd like to make is that there's a misperception that, in my mind, that large consortia impede young investigators from joining the field. And my own experience has been quite the opposite. With organizations like CHAVI in particular, that is more focused on the research side rather than the trial side, there's an opportunity for young investigators to get funding for their projects without having to go through the arduous, first-time application to get a grant, and can help develop a field and develop their career without, with basically free money from the consortia. So I think that there are several opportunities there. And I think the third thing I would say is that for applications that come into us, we pay special attention to new and young investigators and give them special consideration in the funding decisions.
I'm sorry, I hate to disagree with Peggy, but I have to. This is very well for U.S. investigators. There's no career in genomics in Rio or in Chennai.
No, I don't think we disagree on that.
So if I can just touch on the issues that both Mauro and Peggy and David have initiated, which is that on the one hand, the South has been very heavily involved in undertaking the trials. But the question I have is, how do we go beyond that? How do we go to the stage where we are able to get more of the discovery research also being done in the South? How do we build these relationships between North and South, given the lack of the research labs and so on in the South? And what are the ways and mechanisms that we might want to think about for the future to help develop this new cadre of researchers in the South as well? So perhaps, Mauro, you might want to kick us off, and then I'll ask Peggy to comment.
Why are your students?
That's a very good question. I think that's something particular to Brazil and to my setting, in which it's very difficult to attract people to academic careers. So even when we've had the Fogarty Grant for 10 years now, and I always find it difficult to recruit people to go and do PhDs in other countries, in the US. So that's, I think that's particular to Brazil, or maybe even to Rio, because I think people don't have that difficulty in South Africa, for instance. But I think one of the things that you rightly point out, you need to find ways to also have genomics in Rio one day.
Seth, you wanted to comment.
I just think it's a critical priority, and one of the priorities is to make sure that you balance the research capabilities with what you can do at the sites, and that's the important balance. In the past, a lot of training's gone on, people have gotten advanced training, gone home, and there's been no equipment, no ability to do that research. Today, we have these fabulous laboratory facilities that are around the world. We have an opportunity to begin to build those into discovery as well, and we have to do it through a partnership, and I think that is going to be our challenge over the next 5 to 10 years.
I think just to pick up on that, if you look at the Ugandan labs that you have built, I mean, has that become the kind of center that's attracted now younger researchers to focus more on lab science in Uganda? Okay, so let me just take on the next issue related to this. That on the one hand, you know, we want to get more of the discovery research done. We want to engage across the globe. And it's amazing when you look at the panel. I mean, we're talking about a truly global effort. We've got people from four continents. We have Africa, South America, the U.S., and Asia. What are the ingredients that we need to get in order to encourage more communication and more collaboration across the globe so that we're working as one joint effort in dealing with this problem? Let me start off by asking Suniti to comment.
I think people in the South, in the developing country, they go abroad. I mean, they go to the Western world and get trained. And what they need when they come back is the infrastructure. So if you just train researchers in the North and they come back home and there's nothing to take, why would they come back? And so we lose a number of our scientists to the Western world. But if we could have a true collaboration between the North and the South, and they build the infrastructure, the laboratory, and the things we need, maybe not as good as in the West, but at least which we can work in, taking into consideration many things. For example, natural disasters are so common in the developing world. There's a tsunami and everything is gone. Or there's a cyclone and it's gone. So we need to have all that backup. I mean, I'm talking from my experience. I started my lab in an old little kitchen, which was 4 feet by 6 feet. And I just did 2 or 3 tests there. Today, our lab is quality assured by College of American Pathologists. And I would say it is one of the best laboratories in the country for HIV. And it's not a government setup. It is a non-governmental organization. So it is possible by hard work and collaboration. And we collaborate with the Brown University, with the Hopkins, with many other universities in the U.S. So I think that is true collaboration, when they can build up the lab for you. They can build up the training, your capacity, and then give you what is necessary to complete the research. And that is true collaboration between the West and the developing world.
I'm going to throw this open now to the audience, and or maybe the people sitting in the chairs, I won't call you audience, and encourage you to come to the microphone.
state who you are. I see Jose going to the microphone, and then your question.
Yeah, I'm Jose Esparza. You know, a significant absence in the panel is somebody from biotech or from the biotech or pharmaceutical industry. And there is a lot of innovation in the biotech sector. And at the end of the day, the industry has the expertise on product development. And we need to harness both in the creativity of biotech and the expertise of the industry. So my question to the panel is, what are we doing wrong? Or what we should do in the next 2 years, because this panel is for 2010, to remove these incentives or to create incentives that will bring those two important sectors to the field?
Seth, why don't you, I know IAVI has a number of partnerships with the private sector. Why don't you have a stab at this one?
Let me answer, if I can, in three ways, Jose, for that very important question, because at the end of the day, innovation is concentrated in biotech. So, first of all, trying to create incentives to get them engaged at the beginning. No biotech company, I shouldn't say no, but very few are going to say HIV vaccines is where we're going for the company because, you know, that's not seen as a very profitable area. And so one of the challenges, can you take existing biotech companies working in other areas and have them do some experimentation to see if their technologies are relevant? And as you know, we've created an innovation fund just to do that with you to try to see if we can get those companies to engage. And I think if they do have products that are useful, then I think they will engage because you've given them some proof of concept and we have to work it out. But there are also, you know, financial incentives like the advanced market, you know, concept that has been used now for other vaccines that may create an artificial market. And also, if the whole field is moving and big pharma starts getting interested again, they potentially provide a pull. But the other thing I'd like to mention for the future, which is important, is biotech in the developing world. And although it is somewhat nascent, there's really interesting technology. We're working with now two biotech companies in India, one which we're working with on trying to do medicinal chemistry because they are very good at it and they're willing to put a lot of FTEs on the problem, but also one that does in silico, you know, modeling, and they just happen to be some of the best in the world at doing that. And so I think figuring out how to get Chinese biotech and Brazilian biotech and South African biotech and Indian biotech engaged in this is one of the challenges that I think we've got as a field.
I'm wondering if, Jose, does the foundation have programs that could serve as an incentive, or has the foundation been thinking about how to incentivize biotech in the developing world to get involved in vaccines, or is that being done through IAVI?
I want to hear suggestions from you, but we can fund the private sector. We just say within our possibilities. Of course, we impose some conditions, and those conditions are defined by us as global access, our global access strategy. When we fund an academic researcher or a biotech in the future, we will make sure that the results from the research are available, at least they are not impediments to make that research available for products available in developing countries. But we have the possibility.
Okay, thanks.
Anybody else from the audience want to pose a question or make a comment?
Yes, thank you. My name is Zachary Nzeimana from Burundi. I'm working in the Great Lakes Initiative on AIDS, GLIA, a regional initiative set up by the six countries of the Great Lakes region. As some may expect after this conference, when we go back in our countries, the simple question will be just to ask, how far are you with the vaccine, or what are new developments about the AIDS vaccine? And it is not really easy for some who are not researchers like us to give a simple and concrete response. There was really a very interesting PowerPoint presentation from Dr. Seth, but it was not really to capture one message, giving, on one hand, optimistic aspects, showing that really we are near the good results, but on the other hand, we're having some bad news, and to weigh which message we will be giving to our Burundians or Congolese or others, it will not be really easy for me, for example. So just simply to ask, can I have a simple message to give to my communities when I'm back, saying about AIDS vaccine, what is now being done in some few years, and what can be a hope? Because after the end of the day, the hope is to say there is something really interesting some days to share with you. First question. The last one is about, as in some different programs, we face issues of budget allocation about research. Is there any information about maybe challenges you may have or you may face in terms of budget allocation about research about AIDS vaccine? Thank you very much.
All right, two interesting questions. I see Seth grabbing the microphone. Let me phrase the first one like this, Seth. You're in an elevator with a political leader. You're going between floors 1 and 8. What do you say to him or her?
So I will answer that directly, but I want to give you a background statement first, which is 10 years ago, the first vaccine blueprint was written by the lady sitting to my right. And at that point, we really laid out timelines because we had a bunch of products that hadn't been tested. And so what we knew is that we could test these products, and if they worked, you kind of knew what the timeline was. And now I think we're in a different situation because we have a lot more science, yet we don't have a particular product we're putting our money on, and therefore it's much harder to predict the timeline. And so I just want to give that background because, you know, we were probably too optimistic. I know I felt I was when we were doing timelines in those days. Obviously we were, and I think we've learned from that. But to answer, Alan, in your question, I think the answer is an AIDS vaccine is possible. Huge progress in science is being made, and you have to trust science. We will get there. I think that's the answer.
Okay. Peggy?
Well, I wouldn't answer the question, but what I would say is combination prevention. We have tools that we can use and implement and scale up today, and we need to do that, and we need to do it quickly, and we need to do it now. And when we have a vaccine, someday, whenever that is, we can add that as a new tool to the prevention toolbox, but let's not wait for that. Let's do what we can today as much as we can.
I can't remember your second question.
The second question was about budget allocation, and the answer is we are doing much better than we were 10 years ago. The world is spending a much more significant amount of money. I think the critical thing is going to be sustaining this over a period of time. So making sure that the money is available reliably over that period of time and that this flexibility is critical to making sure that it can keep up with the science advances that occur.
The session I was at, we were asked, oh, there's a question over there. Go to the microphone and...
Good evening. It's a very simple question related from the guy that asked before me. That I've been on, working on AIDS about 15 more years, and every world conference is almost the same. There's another 10 years, and then another 10 years, and there will be 5 years, and there, this time is like growing. Every year is growing, and there's no vaccine. But by the other side, I see there are very specific drugs for the fusion, for the nucleus. I mean, very specific medicines are growing so far from every part of the virus, specific for attack this part, but that vaccine is just stopped there. I mean, there's very difficult because virus is changing the tropism and all that kind of reasons that very difficult for me to understand because by the other side, there are very specific, very, directed to every part of the virus that is going to be healing the patient, but the vaccine is like staying here and the drugs are going there. I think like unbalanced, and I can't understand it. Humbly I ask, why? I understand that because every year is the same. I mean, there's no answer for that. Thank you very much.
Excellent question. Peggy, do you want to...
That is a very good question, and there's a level of answers to that. I guess what comes to my mind are several things. First is really a human nature issue, and that is, in general, people have valued treatment more than they have valued prevention. There's a value one can see when one gets treated and the person gets better. It's difficult to see when something doesn't happen. So in general, regardless of what field you're talking about, AIDS or cancer or whatever, treatment is a value to society monetarily more than prevention. And that has driven the innovation from the private sector to make drugs and to sell them, where we don't have that same incentive for prevention. Because look how much vaccines cost. They're generally very cheap. They're given one or a few times, and they last a lifetime, as opposed to a drug that you have to take once a day for the rest of your life. So the incentives, the market incentives for companies to be involved in treatment is much more than vaccines. And third, I would say that because of the special characteristics of HIV and the way it hides itself from the immune system in many ways, has made it much more difficult scientifically to make a vaccine than to make a drug. So the analogy I would make is that we can't cure HIV and we can't have it, we don't have a vaccine either. Because I think that curing HIV and getting rid of that latent virus is the same order of magnitude of difficulty as making a vaccine. And the drugs are more a temporary measure of keeping people alive.
Okay, I was about to say that in the session I was at, the moderator asked the following question: what keeps you awake at night? So I'm going to ask each of the panelists to answer the following question in 25 words or less, and then we'll, I think, wrap up. This is about the future. So the question I'll pose for you, and this is actually a paraphrase of the question that Richard Horton asked at the session this morning: what surprise would you wish for?
Yeah, please.
Well, that wasn't my question. All right, but answer that one.
Hi, I am Livia Pedroza from INRS. I am an old researcher. I have been working on HIV variability to start with, so I was very pessimistic about vaccine in the early 90s. I became optimistic again, but I think it's a very hard problem, and what keeps me awake at night is, it really, should we do efficacy trials? That's what keeps me awake at night. High-risk population is how, and still don't know if it's ethical to go to high-risk populations and put them on vaccine trials when we don't know the time it is necessary to, between vaccination and challenge in an animal model. And that might be a very important question. So that keeps me awake at night. Should we do efficacy trials?
All right, that's a very good issue, and I'll ask the panel. Sure, Seth?
You know, a lot of people who criticize vaccine research criticize the VaxGen trial. As you know, it's a huge controversy whether it should be done or not. And a number of people have said it led to some really important lessons. And I know a lot of people don't believe that because they only focus on the science. But prior to the VaxGen trial, people said, well, you can't do vaccine trials because one of two things will happen. Either you will give the information and there'll be no infections, or people will think they're vaccinated and they will, you know, go out and do wild, you know, activities, high-risk activities, and it won't be ethical. And what's interesting is we now have data from that experience. And what happened is, when you went ahead and counseled people, their risks dropped, the infection rate dropped over time, it started going back up, but it didn't cross the baseline. And to me, that answers that question, because what you've got is obviously a group of people who volunteered, who understood the risks. They didn't have increased risk. In fact, they had decreased risks. But their risk didn't go to zero, which explains ultimately why you need a vaccine. So in essence, that doesn't keep me up at night. Maybe I should start. What keeps me up at night is the issue of people losing interest in HIV and vaccines, and therefore having us continue to make these breakthroughs, be close to having candidates that are really exciting, and not having the finances to be able to keep it moving forward.
Perhaps let me just add one additional perspective, that if we did not do the STEP trial, how would we know that circumcision has some impact on risk of infection? How would we know that pre-existing immunity has some impact? So in a way, those questions could only have been answered by the fact that the human studies were done. And I think what we've learned, certainly in the microbicide field and now in the vaccine field, is that HIV infection is really the critical and the most central safety endpoint as well as efficacy endpoint. And so we do these studies with HIV as the endpoint because it is the ultimate endpoint and the only one we have right now to be able to answer the question of whether the vaccine is safe or efficacious. So we going back to Alan's question.
What surprise would you wish for over the next immediate 5 to 10 years?
Right,
in one sentence, and then so we can cover it, and then close this session.
Well, I have to explain before I give the one sentence. There's some in vitro evidence that suggests that binding antibodies will block the interaction of HIV and dendritic cells. So, if infection begins in some people with the interaction of the HIV virus with the dendritic cell, and if binding antibodies can inhibit that, then maybe we will see a signal, a positive signal of some level from the Thai trial next year. And then we can build on that.
Okay, and I'm going to start with my right and we'll go right across after that.
Can you ask the question again?
So the question was, what surprise would you wish for in the near future? You wanted to know the question, David.
I understand. I hear. I think there is some in one sentence. I wish we could decipher what is it that the few people who are able to keep the virus at bay for a long time, what do they actually have that can help science?
Suniti?
Okay, in very short, a world without AIDS, but I know that's not going to happen. So I would like people to work on, to find out what is it that prevents acquiring the infection in some people in this world. Is it mucosal immunity? Is it cell-mediated? We don't know. But some of them never get infected in spite of repeated exposures. So how is it we have these exposed seronegative people?
There's a lot of surprises I'd like to see, but recently we've been looking for more neutralizing antibodies, and we found some serum that is like super neutralizing, and I would love to find a really new binding site that turned out that you could neutralize pretty easily all the viruses from.
Mauro?
For me, I think just what Peggy said, a signal, a positive signal in the Thai trial next year, and something that leads us through the Thai trial to understand fine correlates of protection.
So at a personal level, I'd like a miracle drug that makes instant hair. But on the HIV front, I mean, it's been amazing what we've seen in terms of the neutralizing capacity of monoclonals like 4E10. The surprise I would like to see is that we're able to find an antigen that is able to stimulate in the human body such a broadly neutralizing antibody.
So I posed the question, so I don't have to answer it. But I think what I'll do is just make a couple of closing remarks, and then Slim, you'll feel free to jump in. I think this has been, to me at least, a very stimulating and interesting conversation. I think rooted, given who's been talking, rooted in a very strong reality of what all of our panelists actually do on a day-to-day basis. So it's not been a crystal balling, which I think would have been a waste of time, but rather a very informed projection as to where the world is going in HIV vaccine research. I think I take from this that the overall view is very positive, but that there are significant scientific challenges. My own view of that is that's a very realistic view, and unless we have a realistic view, we really won't make progress as quickly as possible. And so starting with the STEP trial, which has been my entree into this field, I think the discussion and debate and navel-gazing that's gone on has been outstanding in terms of trying to decide where the field needs to go, rejigging what the priorities are and should be going forward, and recognizing what the needs are in the field. So I personally feel very optimistic about the future, and I think it's reflected in the conversations we've had here this evening. Slim.
So just by way of concluding, I think we've had some amazing discussions and input today. We've looked at the whole range of events. We know what a vaccine is capable of. We saw it in smallpox. And so, you know, we'd really like to have that. But we know that there are many challenges in getting there. And on the one hand, we heard from panel members how the setbacks in the STEP trial and the Pombili trial are actually opportunities to learn. And those were exceptional trials. They're going to teach us an amazing amount about what are some of the key things that will enable us to move forward. I think what we've also got a sense of is that we're not going to solve this problem as isolated groups. This is a global problem. We've got to solve it at a global level. We've got to find the partnerships. We've got to find the mechanisms for us to work south-south, north-south. We've got to build the next generation of researchers. We've got to develop them. We've got to create the opportunities and create the infrastructure for them to thrive. But that ultimately, that all of us, up here at the table, all of you in the audience, all of us are contributing to an HIV vaccine. We're doing so in our own little way, whether it's in participating in trials, whether it's conducting trials, doing research, advocacy. But what makes it all come together is the fact that we share this vision, that a vaccine is doable, a vaccine is possible, and that one day we will have a vaccine. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, I want to make one more surprise and then one comment. The surprise would be that when we gather 2 years from now in Vienna, that this room is filled with activists and people who are demanding that the world focus on a vaccine, make the resources available, and that this is a critical priority. And this conference is particularly important because, as you know, vaccines have not been given a lot of priority. So that would be a big surprise to me, but one we can aim for. I want to extend a special thanks to Alex, who many of you know, who really put this session together and did an incredible job and a lot of work behind it and has been fighting this battle for a very long time, and I'd like to give him a real round of applause for that.
Thank you very much. You've been a wonderful audience. Travel safely back to your hotels.